This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Snow Like Ashes by Sarah Rasch, performed by Kate Rudd. To everyone who read the first horrible draft of this story and did not laugh when 12-year-old me said, "Someday, I'm going to get this published." 1.
Block.
Where?
I can't tell you where. You're supposed to follow my movements.
Well, then slow down. Mother rolls his eyes.
You can't tell an enemy soldier to slow down.
I grin at his exasperation, but my smile is short-lived as the dull edge of his practice sword swipes under my knees. I slam onto the dusty prairie with a back-popping thud, my blade flying from my hands and vanishing into the thigh-high grass nearby. Hand-to-hand combat has always been my weakest area. I blame Sir and the fact that he didn't start training me until I was almost 11. A few additional sessions with a sword might have helped me catch more than 3 of Mother's blows now. Or maybe no amount of training would change how awkward a sword feels in my hands, and how much I love throwing my spinning circular blade of death, my chakram. Predicting an opponent's close-range moves while a sword slashes through my vision has never been a strength of mine. The rays of the sun prickle my skin as I stare up into the blue sky, wincing at a particularly sharp stone under my back. This is the 4th time in the last 20 minutes that I've ended up on the ground, watching stalks of prairie grass billow around my head. My lungs heave and sweat beads down my face, so I stay on my back, basking in this moment of peace. Mother bends into my line of sight, upside down over me, and I hope he attributes the sudden heat in my cheeks to exertion. No matter how many times he puts me on the ground, he never looks anything but handsome. He's the kind of good-looking that makes me physically ache, makes me stumble for chairs when I'm caught unawares. A few pieces of his white Winterian hair dangle by his cheek, the rest of the shoulder-length strands held together by twine. The leather breastplate stretched over his chest highlights the fact that he's spent most of his life using those muscles in combat training, and his arms are lean and uncovered but for brassards. Freckles trail all along his pale face, his neck, his arms, a testament to the blinding sun of the Rania Plains.
Best 6 out of 11?
The hopeful note in his voice, as if he honestly believes that I have a chance at beating him, makes me cock an eyebrow. I groan. Only if the next 6 events can be ranged. Mother chuckles.
I'm under strict orders to get you to win at least 1 sword match by the time William and the rest return.
I narrow my eyes and try to swallow the longing that rushes at me. Sir left with Greer, Hen, and Dendera on a mission to Spring, while the rest of us stayed behind. Mother, the future king, who gets to go on the more dangerous missions because he's been trained since birth in the art of fighting. Allison, Sir's wife, who has never shown the slightest skill in fighting. Finn, 1 other able-bodied soldier, Sir's rule. Mother always has to have a capable fighter to back him up. And me, the perpetually in-training orphan girl, who, despite 6 years of sparring practice, still isn't good enough to be trusted with the important assignments. Yes, I've had to use some of my skills on food scouting assignments to fight off the occasional soldier or disgruntled citizen of one of the 4 Rhythm Kingdoms. But when Sir arranges missions to Spring, missions on which we'll be directly benefiting Winter instead of simply bringing back supplies for the refugees, he always has an excuse for why I can't go.
The Spring Kingdom is too dangerous. The mission is too important. Can't risk it on a teenage girl.
Mother must recognize the way I bite my lip, or the way my focus drifts, because he exhales in a forceful sigh.
You're improving, Mira, really. William just wants to make sure you can fight at close range as well as long range, like everyone else. It's understandable.
I glare up at him. I'm not horrible with hand-to-hand combat. I'm just not you levels of good. Lie to Sir. Tell him I finally beat you. You're our future king. He trusts you. Mothar shakes his head.
Sorry. I can only use my powers for good.
His face twitches, and it takes me a beat to realize the unexpected lie in what he said. He doesn't have any powers. Not really. Not like magic. And that shortcoming has been a struggle our entire lives. I sit up, plucking blades of grass to roll between my fingers, if only so I have something to do in the sudden tension. What would you use magic for? I ask, my words so weak they almost float away.
You mean, besides lying to Sir for you?
Mothar's tone is light, but when I swing to my feet and turn to him, my chest aches at the strain on his face. No, I start. If Winter had a whole conduit again, a conduit that wasn't female-blooded, that any monarch, king or queen, could harness, what would you use the power for? The question tumbles out of my mouth like a smooth stone in a stream, its edges worn clean by how often I roll it around in my head. We never talk about Winter's conduit, the locket that the King Angra Manyu of Spring broke when he destroyed our kingdom 16 years ago, unless it relates to a mission. It's always, we got word that one of the locket halves will be in this place at this time. Never, even if we manage to get our female-blooded conduit put back together, how will we know if the magic works when our only heir is male? Mothar shifts, batting at the grass with his sword as if he's waging a personal war against the prairie.
It doesn't matter what I would do with it. It's not like I can use it.
Of course it matters, I frown. Having good intentions. But he shoots me an exasperated stare before I can even finish.
No, it doesn't,
he counters. The more he says, the faster the words come, pouring out of him in a way that makes me think he needs to talk about it too.
No matter what I want to do, no matter how well I lead or how hard I train, I won't be able to force life into frozen fields or cure plagues or feed strength into soldiers like I would if I could use the conduit. The Winterians would probably rather have a cruel queen than a king with good intentions, because with a queen, they at least have a chance that the magic can be used for them. It doesn't matter what I would do with magic, because leaders are valued for the wrong things.
Mothar pants, his face tight as he hears everything he said, all his worries and weaknesses laid bare. I bite the inside of my cheek, trying not to stare at the way he winces to himself and smacks the grass again. I shouldn't have pushed it. But something deep in me always throbs with the need to say more, to learn as much as I can about a kingdom I've never even seen. Sorry, I breathe and rub my neck. Bringing up a sensitive subject while you're armed wasn't smart on my part. He shrugs, but he doesn't look convinced.
No, we should talk about it.
Tell that to everyone else, I grunt. They just run off on missions and come back bleeding and say, we'll get it next time, and then we'll get the other half, then we'll raise allies and overthrow Spring and save everyone. As if it's all so easy. If it's so easy, why don't we talk about it more?
It hurts too much,
Mothar says. Just that simple. That makes me stop. I meet his eyes, a long, careful gaze. Someday it won't hurt. The promise we refugees always make one another, before going on missions, whenever people come back bleeding and hurt, whenever things go badly and we're huddling together in terror. We'll be better. Someday. Mothar sheathes his blade and pauses, his hand on the hilt, before taking 2 steps toward me and cupping his palm around my shoulder. As I start, my eyes jerking up to his, he realizes what he's doing and pulls his hand back.
Someday,
he agrees, voice clipped. The way he clenches and unclenches the hand that touched me makes my stomach flip over in a spiral of thrill.
For now, all we need to worry about is getting our locket back so we gain standing as a kingdom again and can get allies to fight Spring with us. Oh, and we need to make sure you're able to do more than lie down during a sword fight.
I mock laugh. Hilarious, Your Highness. Mothra flinches, and I know it's from the title I used, the title I have to use. Those two words, Your Highness, are the wedge that keeps us the proper distance apart. Me, an orphaned soldier in training, and him, our future king. No matter our dire circumstances, no matter our shared upbringing, no matter the chill his smile sends over my body, he's still him, and I'm still me. And yes, he needs to have a female heir someday, but with a proper lady, a duchess or a princess, not the girl who spars with him. Mothra draws his sword again as I hunt through the prairie grass for my discarded blade, refocusing on the task at hand rather than on the way his eyes follow me through the tall yellow stalks. Camp stands a few paces ahead of us, the wide prairie lands camouflaging our pale brown and yellow tents. That and the fact that the Rania Plains aren't friendly to travelers has kept us safe for the last 5 years in this pathetic home, or as close to home as we have right now. I pause in my search, staring at the camp with a growing weight on my shoulders. Far enough from spring not to be discovered, close enough to be able to stage quick scouting missions, it's just a smattering of 5 tents, plus 1 pen for horses and another for our 2 cows. Otherwise, the Rania Plains are barren, dry, and hot, even by the sweltering standards of the Summer Kingdom, and as such, they sit empty. A territory none of the 8 kingdoms of Primoria wants to claim. It took us 3 years to get a handful of scrawny vegetables to pop out of our garden, let alone enough crops to make occupying the plains worthwhile for a kingdom. So much conduit magic would have to be used to make the soil yield crops that it'd hardly be worth it. And no one can make a profit from watching the sun set. But all of this is enough to keep the 8 of us alive. 8 out of the original 25 who escaped winter's fall. Thinking about those numbers makes my stomach seize. Our kingdom used to be home to more than 100,000 Winterians, and most of them were massacred in spring's invasion. The ones who weren't now sit in work camps throughout spring. However few are left, waiting in slavery, they're worth enduring this nomadic lifestyle we live now. Those people are winter, pieces of the life we should be leading, and they deserve, we all deserve, a real life, a real kingdom. And no matter how long Sir restricts me to lesser missions, no matter how often I wonder if getting the locket pieces will be enough to win allies and free our kingdom, I'll be ready to help. I know Sir is aware of the dedication pulsing inside me. I know he understands that I share his desire to get Winter back, and someday he won't be able to ignore me anymore. On one trip to Yakim, one of the Rhythm Kingdoms, when I was 12, a group of men cornered Sir and me in an alley, raving about the barbaric, warmongering seasons, how they'd rather we kill each other off so their queen could swoop in and pick through the rubble of our kingdom to find what they blame the seasons for losing. Primoria's source of magic, the chasm atop which our 4 kingdoms sit. They really want us to kill each other? I asked Sir after we managed to escape. I had fought one of them off myself, but as we scaled an alley wall to get away from them, my pride ebbed into confused shame. Somewhere beneath the season kingdoms lies a giant, pulsing ball of magic. And somewhere in our Claren Mountains, there was once an entrance to it. Only the 4 Season Kingdoms lands are affected by the chasm, in the extremity and consistency of their environments. But every king and queen in Primoria, rhythm and season, possesses a portion of that magic in their conduits and can use it to help their kingdoms. The 4 Rhythm Kingdoms hate us for the fact that this is all they have. Magic in objects like a dagger, a necklace, a ring. They hate us for letting the entrance get lost to age and avalanches and memory, for living directly atop the magic and not tearing our kingdoms apart to dig down and get more of it. Sir stopped and crouched to my level, then scooped up a handful of melting snow from the side of the road.
The Rhythm Kingdoms envy us,
he said to the slush.
Our kingdom stays in winter all year, in glorious snow and ice, while their kingdoms cycle through all four seasons. They have to tolerate melting snow and suffocating heat.
He winked at me and pulled up his best smile, a rare treat that made my chest cold with happiness.
We should feel bad for them.
I crinkled my nose at the brown sludge, but I couldn't stop myself from sharing his smile, basking in the camaraderie between us. In that moment, I felt more like a Winterian, more a part of this crusade to save our kingdom than I ever had before. I'd rather have winter all the time, I told him. His smile faded.
Me too.
That was only the first time I felt, knew, that Sir saw the willingness in me. But no matter how often I prove myself, I can never push beyond his restrictions. Though that won't stop me from trying. That's what all of us do. Keep trying to live, to survive, to get our kingdom back, no matter what. I find my practice sword resting in a patch of trampled grass. Muscles spasming with the effort, I pick it up and frown at Mothar, who stares past me into the plains. His face is blank, his expression hidden by the veil that makes him both a perfect monarch and an infuriating friend. What is it? I follow his gaze. Four shapes wobble toward us, heat shaking their silhouettes in illusions of waves. But they're unmistakable even at this distance, and my breath catches in relief. One, two, three, four. They're back. All of them. They survived. Two. Mothar blows past me through the grass.
They're here!
From camp, Sir's wife, Allison, gathers her skirts into a knot and hurries away from the food she's been fixing, and Finn sprints out of a tent with a medical bag. I drop the sword and follow Mothar, focused on the shapes before us. Is that one Sir? Is he leaning too far forward in his saddle? Did he get hurt? Of course he did. Two of them went to the outskirts of Abril, the capital of Spring, and the other two infiltrated one of Spring's seaside ports, Linnea. Neither is terribly deep inside Spring's borders, but they're still within Angra's domain, and any mission there ends in at least some bloodshed. Mothar and I reach them first. Finn's girth doesn't stop him from beating Allison, and he stumbles to a halt seconds behind us, tearing bandages and creams out of the bag. Dendera collapses off her horse, panting on the ground. She's in her late 40s, Allison's age, and her white Winterian hair hangs over a face creased with the slightest wrinkles around her eyes and mouth. She wraps one arm across her waist and turns to Greer as he climbs off his horse.
His leg,
she murmurs, pointing Finn toward the gash in Greer's thigh. Greer waves him back to Dendera.
She's worse,
he says, resting his forehead against his saddle as he takes deep, even breaths. His short ivory hair clings to his head, matted with sweat and blood. Most days it's easy to forget he's the oldest of our group, hiding his age behind his unwavering determination to take on any task, any mission. Hen slides off his horse next to Dendera, wrapping one of her arms around his shoulders to keep her up. The way he cradles her makes me want to look away, like I'm watching something intimate. It shouldn't feel any different than the way we all treat each other, a haphazard army with Sir as our commander rather than a family. But I can't help wonder whether, if our situation was better, Dendera and Hen would want to be a true family. All four of them bleed from various spots on their bodies, torn shirts and makeshift bandages stained brown-red with a mix of dried and fresh blood. Sir is the only one who eases off his horse and stands straight, towering and immovable and watching us detachedly. With all the time I spend with Mothar, I should be better at decoding emotionless looks. But I just hover there, my body frozen with anxiety, unable to move to help Finn and Mothar pass out bandages. My eyes travel up and down each horse, each bag. Did they get the locket half?
William!
Allison's shriek precedes her by a few heartbeats as she hurls herself at her husband, injuries be damned. Seeing Sir wrap his arms around her, hold her tiny body off the ground, is like watching a bear clutch a rag doll. Power and might alongside fragility and meekness. They fold into each other in a rare moment of vulnerability. Sir sets down his wife.
It's in Linnea. Got there the day we left.
Finn lowers the handful of bandages he pressed against Greer's leg. Mother looks up from where he holds a small water sack for Dendera as she drinks. I suck in mouthfuls of the hot, heavy air, my mind whirling. We've been searching for the locket throughout Primoria since winter fell. But only a handful of times have we gotten leads on where one of the halves would be. Angra keeps half of it moving, bouncing from cities in spring to remote settlements in the unclaimed areas of Primoria, the foothills of the Paisel Mountains, ports on the sea, to make it harder for us to get both halves back. Now we're close. My chest swells with the same excitement that I know everyone is feeling, or felt before they ended up here, broken and bleeding. Sir will send someone back for it. Fresh and rested people make for the best soldiers, so he won't send anyone who just returned, which means... I rush toward Sir as he looks Mother up and down, then does the same to Finn.
You two, leave now, he says. They'll move it again soon, since they know we escaped.
I stop. They'll need everyone. I'll go too. Sir looks at me like he forgot I'd be here. He frowns, shakes his head.
Not now. Mother, Finn, I want you ready to leave in 15 minutes. Go.
Finn scurries off, his bulk swaying around him as he hurries back to camp. Obedient without thought, like everyone always is. I stare up at Sir with my jaw clenched. I can do this. I'm going. Sir grabs his horse's reins and starts walking it toward camp. Everyone falls in behind him, except Mother, who hangs back farther, watching us, his eyes calm.
I don't have time to argue this, Sir snaps. It's too dangerous.
Too dangerous for me, but not for our future king? Sir looks at me as I walk alongside him.
Did you beat Mother in sparring?
I grimace. Sir reads that as my answer.
That's why it's too dangerous for you. We're too close to take any chances.
Prairie grass pushes against my hips, my boots tearing into the dirt with every step. You're wrong, I growl. I can help. I can be-
You do help.
Oh, yes, that bag of rice I bought in autumn last month saved our kingdom.
You're most helpful where you are,
he amends. I grab his arm to make him stop. He turns to me, his face streaked with dirt and blood through his white beard, frizzled strands of ivory hair sticking out around his face. He looks tired, hovering between taking one more step and collapsing. I can do more than this, I breathe. I'm ready, William. I called him father once. In the wake of his stories about my real parents dying in the streets of Winter's capital, January, as spring overtook it, and how he scooped baby me up and rescued me. It seemed logical to an 8-year-old that the man raising her should be called father. But he turned such a shade of red that I feared he'd start spitting blood, and he growled at me like he'd never done before. He was not my father, and I was never, ever to call him that again. I was only ever to call him by his name or a title or something to show respect, but not father. Never, father. So from then on, I called him sir. Yes, sir. No, sir. You are not my father, and I will never be your daughter, and I hate that you're all I have, sir. Now he ignores me, pulling his horse onward. His decisions are final, and no amount of arguing will change his mind. Like that's ever stopped me. This isn't enough, and while I can't fault you for caring about the most efficient ways to save our kingdom, I know I can do things for Winter, too. A few paces behind me, Dendera moans, still hanging off Hen's neck. Mira, she says, her voice worn. Please, dear. You should be grateful you aren't needed. I whip to her. Just because you'd rather be patching dresses doesn't mean all women should want that. Her mouth drops open, and I pinch my eyes closed. I didn't mean it like that, I sigh, forcing myself to look at her. She leans more heavily on Hen now, her eyes glistening. I just meant that you shouldn't be forced to fight when you don't want to, and I shouldn't be forced to not fight when I want to. If Sir let me go, maybe you wouldn't have to go on missions. Everyone would win. Dendera doesn't look any less hurt, but she glances at Sir, a quiver of hope hidden behind her pain. She used to be like Allison, tending to camp, until Sir got desperate. He started needing her for missions just as he started letting me help with food scouting. She's never argued with him, not when he makes her train or when he sends her out on missions like these, but one look in her eyes and I can see how much this life terrifies her. How badly she'd rather be back at camp. She's as uncomfortable with weapons as I'd be in a gown. Mother strides over to me through the grass, and I think he might try to offer words to break the tension. But after a few paces, he crumples to the ground like the earth sucked him down and refuses to release him. I frown as he grips his ankle.
Ow!
He howls. Sir bends down in a quick rush of panic.
What happened?
Martha rocks back and forth and winces as everyone else moves closer.
Mira beat me in that last fight, didn't she tell you? Knocked me flat out. I don't think I can go to Linnea.
The wrinkles in Sir's face relax.
Didn't I see you run out to meet us?
Martha doesn't miss a beat, still rocking and wincing.
I ran through the pain.
I suck in a breath until Sir looks up at me, and Martha winks discreetly above a wide grin.
You beat him?
Sir asks, disbelieving. I shrug. I'm a horrible liar, so I just leave it at that. Martha is helping me. A blush warms my cheeks. Sir has to know we're lying, but he won't risk sending Martha on the chance that he really did sustain an injury. He does trust him, more than anyone here. A moment passes before Sir rubs his temples and shoots a sharp breath out of his nose.
Help Martha into camp, then get your chakram.
I bite back my squeal of triumph, but it comes anyway. A weird blubbery noise that catches in my throat and bursts out of my still frowning mouth. Sir stands, takes his horse, and marches into camp with renewed determination, like he doesn't want to face me now that he's given in. Everyone trails after him, leaving me to help Martha the invalid. When the others are out of earshot, I fall to the ground and throw my arms around him.
You're my favorite monarch in the history of monarchs, I babble into his shoulder.
His arms come around me, squeeze once, shooting rays of chill through my body as I realize we're hugging. I fly to my feet and extend my hand to him, certain my face will be permanently stained red.
We should get back.
Martha takes my hand but pulls down as I pull up, keeping me from leaving.
Wait.
He turns to fish for something in his pocket and I lower to my knees beside him, my eyebrows pinching slightly. When he pivots back, his face is solemn, and the ball of nervousness in my stomach expands. In the center of his palm sits a round piece of lapis lazuli, one of the rarer stones Winter used to mine from the Clarins long ago.
I found it when we were staying in Autumn a few years back.
Martha starts, his eyes soft.
After the lesson William gave us on Winter's economy, our mines in the Clarins digging up coal and minerals and stones.
He pauses, and I can see the child he was then. We moved to Autumn 8 years ago, a boy prince pretending to be a soldier, and a girl orphan who wanted nothing more than to pretend right alongside him.
I liked to think it was magic,
he continues, his face severe.
After our lessons about the seasons sitting on the chasm of magic, and our lands being directly affected by the power, and Angra breaking Winter's conduit and taking our power in one swift crush of his fist, I wanted, needed, to believe that we could get magic somewhere else. Our world may seem balanced. 4 kingdoms of eternal seasons, 4 kingdoms that cycle through all seasons. 4 kingdoms with female-blooded conduits, 4 with male-blooded. But it's not balanced. It will always be tipped in favor of monarchs who have magic versus people who don't, like their citizens and other monarchs whose conduits break. And I hated being so...
His voice trails off.
Helpless,
he finishes. My brow creases. You're far from helpless, Mother.
His half-smile returns and he shrugs.
At the very least, this lapis lazuli was a connection to winter. And having it helped me feel stronger, I guess.
I bite my lip, not missing how he brushed past what I said. He takes my hand and rolls the stone into my palm.
I want you to have it.
Giddiness floods my senses when Mothra doesn't let go of my hand, doesn't look away from me. And the light flickering in his eyes? This is important to him. He's passing me a part of his childhood. I pull the lapis lazuli closer to examine it in the dying sunlight. It's impossibly blue, no bigger than a coin, with darker strands of azure running along its surface. Outside of the Lost Chasm, magic has only ever existed in the royal conduits of the Eight Kingdoms and Primoria, reserved for rulers to use as needed. Not in objects like this small blue stone, sitting so inconspicuously in my palm. But I know why Mothra wanted to believe the stone has magic. Sometimes placing our belief in something bigger than ourselves helps us get to a point where we can be enough on our own. Magic or no magic.
Not that I don't think you'll be fine, he adds. It just helped me sometimes, having a piece of winter with me.
I squeeze the stone, coolness gathering in my chest beside the slow, dull thudding of my heart.
Thank you.
I nod to his ankle.
For everything. You didn't...
He shakes his head.
Yes, I did. You deserve to fight for your home as much as the rest of us do.
I swallow. We're still alone outside of camp, with only the faint breeze pushing through the grass and a few scraggy trees nearby.
I should pack.
Mothra nods, his face blank again with that maddening, impenetrable nothingness. He fakes a limp into camp, my shoulder under one of his arms to help the charade. I keep a hand around his waist, the other clutching the lapis lazuli. I'm barely able to draw in full breaths, I'm so aware of his body against mine, of how when I look at him, I see the life Sir says we're fighting for. Something simple and happy. Just Mothra and me in a cozy cottage in winter. But he's not just Mothra. He is winter. He will always be winter first and foremost, and there is a palace in his future, not a cottage. So I help him over to the fire and hurry to pack what I'll need for the trip, moving and doing in silence because silence is infinitely easier than talking. And now, finally, I'm moving and doing what I've always wanted, helping my kingdom. 3. When I was 8, we moved our camp once again to make it harder for Engra to track us, this time to Autumn. Until then, my life had been no bigger than the perimeters of our sad little camps in the Eldridge Forest. We passed through Autumn's capital, October, on our way to their southern forests, filling our carts and loading our horses with supplies. Autumn was as similar to the foliage-heavy Eldridge as a snowflake is to a flame. The dense humidity of the Eldridge was non-existent in Autumn's dry coolness, its yellow and red forests sleepy and crunchy and colored with warmth. October was a maze of rickety barns and tents in maroon, azure, and sunshine orange, with the crystalline blue sky gleaming above, a sharp and beautiful contrast to the kingdom's earth tones. But it was the Autumnians themselves who left me gaping. They were beautiful. Their hair hung in tendrils as dark as the night sky, swaying in the dust kicked up from the roads that wove through Autumn's tent cities. Their skin glistened the same coppery brown as the leaves on some of their trees, only where the leaves were crinkled and dry, the Autumnians' faces were perfectly creamy. I touched my own skin, as pale as the clouds drifting over us, and ran my fingers across the cap covering my blindingly white hair. My entire life, I had been surrounded only by the other Winterian escapees. It had never occurred to me that anyone might look different. But as I gazed at black eyes set in lush brown skin, I wished for my skin to be that pretty shade, and for my blue eyes to be a dark mystery, too. I told my wish to Allison, who was tasked with keeping Martha and me out of trouble while everyone else gathered supplies. Her brow pinched in the wake of my admission. The world is full of lovely people, Mira. I bet somewhere there is an Autumnian girl wanting to have skin the color of snow just as you want skin the color of earth. My gaze flicked around, but I didn't see anyone watching us, at least not with the same yearning with which I watched them. I tugged at my cap. Then why do we have to hide our hair? Allison's hand went to her own hair, wrapped up in a blue length of fabric. In retrospect, hiding our white hair didn't do much to keep people from realizing who we were. If anything, it only made them look at us twice, noting first our hats or fabric-wrapped heads, then our pale skin and blue eyes and how wholly out of place we were. But Sir never backed down in his insistence that we needed to at least try to disguise ourselves, lest Angra get word of our location. After a deep inhale, Allison touched my cheek, her fingers cool. You won't have to hide forever, sweetheart. Someday our features will blend in, not stand out. I doubt she meant blending into spring. I shove my hands into the pockets beneath my heavy black cloak, the dense wool swaying around the weapons strapped to my back and legs. The cloak's hood covers my head, hiding me in shadows as I stroll casually down the dirt road, the darkness of midnight falling on me from the half-moon sky. Every few seconds I peek up through the hood, noting the walls of Linnea just ahead, the gate at the end of this road flanked by flickering torches and a handful of spring guards. A shiver runs down my spine, but I keep my posture tall and confident, adding a cocky sway to my step the closer I get to Linnea's north gate. The Fenai River gurgles off to my left, marking the northern border of spring before it flows out to the Destus Sea. A bridge connects to the gate up ahead, linking Linnea to the Rania Plains over the river in a wide swoop of stone and wood. My eyes dart over it, to the darkened field beyond, before swinging back ahead. An escape route to keep in mind. The Kingdom of Spring stretches to my right, drastically different from the barren, grassy prairie lands of the Rania Plains. In the daytime, rolling hills of lush greenery cascade all around. Forests of blossoming cherry trees, fields of wildflowers in a rainbow of colors. In the nighttime, spring looks far more like what it really is. Cloaked in shadows, everything drenched in black. It didn't take long to travel to Linnea, what with the breakneck pace Finn demanded. A little more than 2 days after we set out, we reached the port city. We hid our horses in an abandoned barn and waited until night, then split up to approach Linnea from the north and the south. Getting into Linnea is the easy part. Getting out will be the fun part. One other traveler strides down the road in front of me, a man slumped on his horse. He reaches the guards first, mumbles something about finding work at Linnea's docks the next day, and after a few moments of quiet muttering, they let him pass unmolested. I swallow. Based on the recon work Finn and I did, the patrol in Linnea has been increased along the wall and gates, making it impossible to sneak in unnoticed. But it is possible to pass as a spring citizen and waltz into Linnea with the guard's blessing. I keep my pace steady as I approach.
Halt!
One guard orders, flinging out a hand to block my way. I step back, careful to keep my face out of the direct light of the sconces on my right and left.
On my way to the Dancing Flower Inn.
I recite the cover Finn and I came up with. My voice rumbles out low and deep to make myself as gender neutral as possible.
Meeting a man for work.
Which isn't entirely a lie. Well, the Dancing Flower Inn is a lie. Sir told us about it and a handful of other landmarks in Linnea. Our real mark is the keep, Linnea's seat of government and, according to Sir, the location of the locket half. My eyes flick past the guards, all five of them, to the great circular tower that looms above the other buildings in Linnea. It's in the center of the city, at least a half-hour trip. Finn will have the same from his end of the city. I swing my gaze back to the guards. Two study me, the rest lean lazily against the wall,
their breastplates gleaming in the flickering torchlight, silver armor with a black sun on their chests. Angra's sun. I'm not sure how much tighter I can ball my fists. My nails are already digging into my palms.
Lots of people coming in for work at this hour. Odd, isn't it?
One of the guards cocks his head, his spring blonde hair shorn against his scalp, his green eyes translucent in the combination of firelight and darkness. Exactly what I was counting on. I finally tip my head back, the hood of my cloak sliding just enough for the firelight to touch my face. The flames will wash out my blue eyes just as they do his, making me look, enough for the guards at least, like a green-eyed spring citizen. Spring citizens have skin a few shades darker than Winterians, but pale nonetheless. And the yellow light should make me look enough like one of them that they'll let me pass. I hope. No amount of tricks of the light could make my hair look anything but white, so it remains tucked safely under a black cap, which will also make me look more like a boy than a girl, I hope. So many I hopes. I bite my tongue, keeping my focus on the guard. His eyes flash over me, one brow lifting in an expression that makes my blood freeze solid in my veins.
And what kind of work are you meeting this man for, girl?
He sneers. His comrades perk up. The fact that they know I'm a girl isn't ideal, but that's the part of my disguise I'm least worried about. If they know I'm a Winterian, it will be 100 kinds of bad. I draw in a calming breath and pull up the coyest smile I can manage, angling my body slightly toward him. Work you can't afford, I reply, throwing him a wink and strutting past them into the city. I hold my breath, waiting for them to shout at me to stop, waiting for one of them to run after me and try to convince me that actually he can afford it. But all I hear is a roar of laughter, and one of the guards applauds.
Make our king proud!
He shouts, and I hurry into the city, leaving the jeering soldiers far behind before disgust or fear can creep up on me at what I just did. I yank my focus back to the task at hand. The port on the northeastern coastal tip of Spring, Linnea is sleepy and calm and lacking any hint of Spring's usual brutality, mainly because the closest Winterian work camp is a day's ride inland. Angra can't have damaged, hollow Winterian slaves sullying Spring's image when trading ships from other kingdoms dock here. Linnea's peace is only a mask painted on so the rest of the world can pretend that cracked and withered Winterian hands didn't make the goods they buy. The streets around the gate aren't exactly busy, but they aren't empty either. A few taverns stand in halos of firelight, the ruckus of laughter and music emanating in muffled bursts from within. A handful of drunkards stumbles from tavern to tavern, but that's it. As if the rest of Linnea would rather stay tucked in their beds than partake of nighttime frivolities. I've been in enough of Primoria's cities to know this isn't normal. Most cities stay loud and bright even after the sun sets, and sneaking through them is all too easy. But in Spring, everything is quieter and more tense. If I stand still and hold my breath, I can practically feel Angra's evil. The way he uses his conduit's magic to pour devotion into his people so that every Spring citizen responds to every situation like the guard. Make our king proud. Other kingdoms use their conduits as they should be used, to enhance the already existing strengths of their lands and people, to make fields yield a plethora of fruit, to make soldiers strong, to make sick people healthy. But Angra uses his conduit to enhance the bad, to snuff out anything good unless it benefits him, to make every soul in his kingdom an empty shell of servitude. I duck down a deserted alley, heart-pumping adrenaline in thick rivers through my body, but I don't slow my pace, even as I reach the stack of crates against a wall at the end. In a burst of movement, I'm up the crates, scaling the wall and rolling onto the tiles of the roof next to me, a handful of stories in the air. Spring soldiers may find Linnea's deserted streets easier to patrol, but spotting enemy soldiers on rooftops is a slightly more difficult task. Chunks of tile crumble under my boots as I push into a sprint, a breath away from the edge of the roof and three stories of night air.
I launch into the void, black cloak fluttering behind me through a smokestack's bitter cloud. The next roof slides under me like a field beneath a horse's hooves, nothing but speed and the jolt of running feet meeting solid ground. I drop roll into the shadow of a chimney and wait a moment, holding my breath. No shouts of alarm. No clanking of armor moving closer. Towering over the city, I have an unobstructed view of the land beyond Linnea's walls. The silhouette of the Clarins paints jagged black teeth across the southern horizon, a quiet, sleeping beast that watches over all the seasons. The summer kingdom farthest west, autumn next, then winter, and finally the spring kingdom on the Destus Sea. I wish we could see each other as the mountains see us, resting side by side in the arms of a watchful giant, instead of as separated, divided enemies. If we did, maybe together we could find the way back into the chasm of magic. My fingers run over my pocket, Mother's lapis lazuli ball tucked against my thigh, and I growl at myself. Sir would have slapped me across the back of my head by now to get me to refocus on what I'm doing instead of what might be done. I clear the next rooftops without a problem, angling my progress toward the keep under the blue-black sky. The only thing that concerns me now is the shadow scaling the western wall of the tower. Finn should be a horrible soldier, but for whatever reason, his short, stubby blob of Winterian girth has outdone my only slightly taller stick figure of Winterian agility on every mission we've worked together. Without hesitation, I fling myself from the last roof to a horizontal pole protruding from the side of the tower, Spring's flag rippling below me, a black sun against a yellow background. Random things, these flagpoles. Almost as though the architects included them in the design, should enemy soldiers need a quick way to get inside. When we rebuild Winter, there won't be flagpoles on buildings. Anywhere. Period. Windowsill, balcony. Windowsill, pole. I leap in this pattern until I reach the highest balcony. The warm orange glow of firelight pours through a gap in the center of thick curtains, and Finn is already there, perched on the balcony ledge, grinning at me. I swing up across from him and mouth, "I hate you." He grins more widely. We hold for a moment, listening for any signs of life within. According to Sir, this room is the city master's office. No noise echoes back to us except for the steady crackle of a fire and the gentle whooshing of the curtains dusting the stone floor in the breeze. I glance over my shoulder, surveying the night below us. From the balcony, it's a straight drop to the street with a few windowsills along the way. Another escape route to keep in mind. From the keep, at least. We ease onto the balcony floor and scoot toward the curtains. Finn peeks through a gap, his eyes flickering in the golden glow, before he nods to me. The room is empty. Adrenaline makes me twitchy with excitement as I grab one of the curtains, pull it back, and slip inside the office. The fireplace in the back corner roars, stoked high with logs. The city master must plan on returning soon. High-backed chairs stand in a circle on a lush scarlet rug before the fire, and a desk stands against one wall. Above the desk hangs an old yellowed map that shows the kingdoms of Primoria surrounded by the Destus Sea to the east, the endless Rania plains sweeping between the kingdoms and out to the west, and impassable mountains to the north and south. A few sconces hang on the walls, but that's it. Simple and straightforward. I make for the desk while Finn, still on the balcony, keeps an eye on the closed office door. Most of the drawers are unlocked, cluttered with quills and ink jars and blank pieces of parchment. My fingers fly through the odds and ends, sorting and searching as noiselessly as I can. The information Sir gave us just before we left flies across my mind and helps calm my racing heart.
We were able to steal a map of the keep. We think they're hiding it somewhere underneath it, in a cellar, maybe. Wherever it is, it'll be locked. So find the key first, most likely in the city master's office.
I repeat those words in my head as I fly through drawers, look under papers, shuffle ink jars. Nothing. Finn hisses as voices waft toward me from beyond the door. Someone's coming. Panic leaps through me, dizzying surges that make it difficult to sort through everything carefully.
I slide the last drawer shut. The voice is outside, close enough that I can make out a few words.
So honored to have you. Welcome, Herod.
I stumble into the desk, body convulsing with dread as I meet Finn's eyes across the room. My mouth forms the question, Herod? Finn beckons me to hurry. Nothing about his demeanor changes, his 42 years making him slightly more adept than I am at controlling emotions. But it isn't just emotions that swell inside me at the name. Memories slam through my head, one after another, gore and horror and fear all stemming from General Herod Montego. I push away the images of our soldiers stumbling back into camp with bones protruding from their chests, delirious with pain, and I grab onto Sir's advice.
Focus on the goal. Don't get sidetracked. Don't let fear take hold of you. Fear is a seed that once planted never stops growing.
No fear. Not now, not here. I scan the desktop once more in desperation, the sound of laughter coming from just beyond the door. They're right outside. A letter tucked under a heavy iron paperweight in the shape of a wildflower. I grab the letter without pausing to consider what it says and dive for the balcony, boots swishing across the stone floor. One breath after I'm outside, after the curtain flutters back into place, one breath after they would have seen my shadow flicker on the stone floor. The door opens, and voices barrel toward us. Finn peers through the slit between the curtains, holding up his hand, flashing fingers to tell me how many he sees. 5 soldiers, 2 servants, 4 nobles. He drops his eyes to the paper in my hand and nods me along, half his focus on the conversation behind the curtain. I shift in my crouch across from him and take deep, calming breaths before staring at the paper. My hands stop shaking enough that I can hold it in the slit of firelight.
Report. To all spring officials. Work camp population statistics. Abril camp. 469. Bikendi Camp, 141. Zorian Camp, 564. Edurne Camp, 476.
The document goes on to describe how many deaths, how many births, what things were built by what camps, but my hands are shaking again and I can't focus on the words. These are the Winterian statistics in spring's work camps. The numbers are... people. I touch the numbers, my fingers trembling. Such small totals. Did we know it was this bad? I suspected it was. Sir's lessons on the fall of winter were graphic. The way he described how Angra planned the attack, as if he knew winter would fall on that day. How he stationed every soldier he had throughout winter, moving them in secret until everything exploded in one unavoidable sweep of destruction. There was nowhere to run. Angra blocked off any retreat into Autumn, or the Clarins, or the northern Fenai River. He barricaded us in our own kingdom, and when he broke the locket, when our soldiers had no magic-given strength to help them stand against him, we fell. Only 25 of us managed to escape. I feel the weight of that now, seeing the statistics proved what Sir has been saying for years. Every day, we're teetering on the edge of Winterians becoming nothing more than memories.
I trust my king, I do.
A voice booms within the room. I snap my head up, all the adrenaline and fear warping into anger. Finn tightens his lips in warning, and I thrust the paper at him in response.
And I know it was scheduled to be here longer.
The voice continues.
But I want it out of my city, tonight. Before any more Winterian scum descends upon us.
The City Master. I exhale. The locket half is still here. We haven't lost it yet. My relief is short-lived when Finn scans the paper, looks back up at me, and the expression he gives isn't fear or shock. It's just pain. Regret. My eyes widen.
Did you know how bad it is?
I mouth. He tucks the paper into his belt and bobs his head once. Yes, he knew, Everyone in camp probably knows. It's just one of the things they don't talk about. One of the two painful parts of our past. And I knew, too. I just didn't have exact numbers in my head to fuel my rage. Herod laughs, and my nerves flare higher. Killing him is going to feel so good.
Calm yourself. It will be gone within the hour.
It's safe here.
A different voice, probably one of Linnea's councilmen.
I don't care if the Winterians know it's here. Linnea can keep it protected far better than any other city.
Silence!
The city master shouts. But Herod chuckles.
Ambitious, your man.
Not ambitious,
the councilman corrects. I hear a rustling as someone walks across the room. My heart ricochets around my ribs. They're going to the desk. Will they notice that the paper is gone?
Certain. The safe we built for it. It's perfect. The keep above.
Excellent. The location of the locket half. Sir was right. It's under the keep. A harsh movement from within is followed by the crack of the councilman's face meeting Herod's fist. Bodies move, chairs fall, and amidst the ruckus, Herod's voice rises.
Do not speak of its location. That was our arrangement. You hide it and never utter a word of the location. It isn't safe so long as that boy breathes.
I bristle. Mother will keep breathing so long as I am breathing, you murderer. But the councilman doesn't react. Something shuffles, and I realize it's papers on the desktop. The thunk of a paperweight. I widen my eyes at Finn, who grimaces before the councilman even speaks.
The
councilman starts, clearly confused.
Something's missing.
A pause, then a growl resonates in the stillness. I can taste Herod's fury on the air as his growl morphs into three words that make my heart plummet.
We aren't alone.
4.
Boots pound across the room. The curtain flashes open as Finn and I leap, dropping face first off the balcony and into the cool night. Winterians!
Herod screams.
Lock it down now!
In the seconds of free falling before I hit the ground, I find myself faced with two options. Continue my fall, drop into a roll on the street, and make all haste out of Linnea in the hope that we can get back in later. Or cling to the building and find a way inside. Key or not, we're so close to the locket half that something as small as a jagged piece of metal shouldn't stop us. But the plan was that if either of us ran into trouble, Finn and I were to regroup outside the city. If we leave now, though, getting back in will be impossible. They'll move the locket half without hesitation, and we'll be back where we started. My body makes the decision before I do. The rock wall shreds my fingers as I scramble against it, and two windowsills fly past before I find purchase on one, body jerking to a halt, wrists screaming at having to support my weight so abruptly. I flail, arrows barely grazing my kicking legs and straining arms as I scramble against the rock, searching for footholds, and use a few chipped pieces of mortar to pull myself up and over the windowsill. The window pops inward, and I tumble inside, blinking in the darkness until my vision adjusts. Please don't let this room be anything with soldiers inside. Maybe a kitchen, or a nice cozy bedchamber, or... I look around wildly. A storage room. It's a storage room. Empty, but for stacks of shadowed crates in the narrow, lightless space. Perfect. Outside, Herod's voice carries, screaming about Linnea's failures. I peek over the windowsill and spot Finn's plump shadow skirting into an alley. He pauses, face caught in a ray of moonlight as he scans the area. He doesn't see me, and I don't want to draw any spring attention by waving. He'll go back to camp now, I know. Another of our protocols. If one of us goes missing, the other is to leave immediately. Before I realize the full extent of what I've done, how alone I am now, Finn's gone. He'll tell Sir I vanished in the chaos, and Sir will growl something about how he never should have let me go in the first place. I have to prove him wrong. My arms are too rubbery from my windowsill grab to throw my chakram,
so I settle for the curved knives hidden in my boots. One in each hand, I creep across the narrow storage room. The door opens easily enough, and I fly out, knives ready, heart racing.